Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. Each week we go in depth with Baylor leaders, professors, and more, discussing important topics in higher education, research, and student life. I'm Derek Smith, and our guest today is Dr. Kenneth Hafertieff. Dr. Hafertieff serves as department chair and professor in Baylor's Department of Museum Studies. Dr. Hafertieff is a leading authority on the material culture and decorative arts of the U.S., particularly of those here in Texas. A widely published author, Hafertieff wrote Historic Homes of Waco, Texas, an authoritative book on Waco house history featuring over 120 entries released in February. He served on a variety of boards and associations. He's a member of the City of Waco's Historic Landmark Preservation Commission, and he's with us today on Baylor Connections. Dr. Hafertieff, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Howdy. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here as we discuss a topic that is really first and foremost on a lot of people's minds. And it's funny, you know, you came here to Baylor in 2000. Mm-hmm. This was already a topic you loved, homes, architecture, and styles. When you got here in 2000, could you ever have imagined that there would be this kind of thirst for information about homes in Waco that stretches border to border, internet searches, everything?
Even further, yeah. In a word, no. I couldn't have imagined it. It's really quite remarkable. It's interesting in that there's a broad popular interest in Waco houses now, and that's actually sort of carried over into the academic world. I've joked that when I came to Baylor in 2000, that doing a book on Waco houses would have been considered academic suicide. Mm-hmm. And now my dean can't figure out why it took this long for me to write it. And that sort of inevitability has just happened in the last 5-6 years. And the reason that I joke about it being academic suicide is that there's a tendency to look at architecture off the East Coast as being provincial and not having the sort of level of creativity of big-name architects working in New York or Boston or mm-hmm. Philadelphia or something along those lines. So part of what happened is that as I live in a place, I tend to get very interested in the built environment around me, just driving around and just trying to figure out what came first, what came second, and what came third, and why. It turned out that there was a way of making it a book that was academically interesting, academically significant. But I also try to write in English when I write a book. I don't want it to be in academic jargon that a regular intelligent reader won't understand. And it's actually been quite gratifying that folks mm-hmm. in Waco have seemed to embrace the book. So that's a good feeling.
You know, it's academically, it got some academic rigor, but it's also something that people could put on a coffee table and page through and look through.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's academic study meets coffee table book.
That's great.
For sure.
That's great. Well, when you moved here in 2000 with that eye towards learning about the region you're in, what did you notice about Waco homes?
Well, one thing that jumped out at me, which I had in my times of driving through Waco before had not noticed, was how important the 1920s were in the history of Waco. There are period homes, as they're called. That sounds like kind of a broad name for it. But homes that are reviving a particular type of styles. That might be colonial revival. It's basically, you know, East Coast colonial, but also Spanish colonial revival, Tudor revival, Mediterranean, Dutch. There are all sorts of it was a time when people wanted to pick a period and then build something that approximated what had been built 100, 200 years ago. And there's actually a very rich range of those in Waco, and it really hadn't been studied before. So that was exciting to dive into that.
What styles or what periods have been most meaningful to you or you're most interested in?
Well, when I came here, most of the research that I'd been done tended to be done on mid-19th century. I did a book on Abner Cook, the master builder who did the Texas Governor's Mansion. I wrote a book about the Smithsonian Castle and tended to be the very earliest Texas houses. So this was an unusual book for me in that it went from the very earliest Waco houses, Greek Revival of the 1850s and 1860s, and the Victorian, for which I had a longstanding interest. But it continues on into the first four decades of the 20th century, and that is basically been written about only in a handful of local history articles. So it was an untouched area. So to be able to look at everything from the castle in Castle Heights to what until recently was the Cotton Palace Bed and Breakfast and all of the interesting houses in Castle Heights and in Sanger Heights was getting to look at a era of Waco history that had just never really been studied in a thorough manner. So that was pretty fun to be able to dive right into that.
We are talking Waco architecture with Dr. Kenneth Hafertepe here on Baylor Connections. And Dr. Hafertepe, what's something that when you visit a community, certainly Waco, what can we learn about that place from the homes there? Maybe things that as a layman we might not notice.
Yeah, well, part of it is as you drive through a community, you can see the patterns of development. That obviously the downtown area was the core of Waco from a very early date, but it's interesting as you look at the old Waco houses that there was not a lot of development to the north of downtown, which is to say north of Barron's Creek, for quite a while. The biggest development tended to be heading in the direction of Interstate 35 and where Baylor is nowadays. But as the 19th century wore on, it went further and further to the west. But at this point, Castle Heights was empty farmland and that sort of thing. And it's really quite interesting just thinking about these houses being built when it was on the edge of the city. And now we think of it as being very much inner city. And what we call Sanger Heights now was a subdivision of the early 20th century as well. So, and as the development goes on, each subdivision has its own favorite styles and particular styles. And so you can look at that and even just driving down a street like Colcord Avenue or Austin Avenue, you can see which houses came first. And then as the succession of houses goes on, you can see infill from later period. And it's interesting. It just isn't an obvious natural progression. You have to look pretty carefully at it. And part of it, too, is looking at those artifacts and seeing what's original and what's been changed. Mm-hmm. So that it does take a pretty careful eye in terms of dating things. And you can't necessarily assume that everything you see is original.
We are visiting with Dr. Kenneth Hafertepe, Department Chair and Professor in Baylor's Department of Museum Studies. Well, let's talk a little bit about the book, Historic Homes of Waco, Texas. How did you go about compiling that?
Well, the first thing that happened was what we refer to in the trade as a windshield survey, mm-hmm. driving around town. And trying to figure out which are the oldest houses and the most significant houses over the decades that I write about, basically from the beginning of Waco in 1849-50 up to the start of World War II. And so just driving around and getting curious about what there is left in the Waco built environment was pretty key. Another thing is that as a professor in museum studies, I've taken my students many times to the historic homes run by Historic Waco Foundation in class times. And those are the sort of things that museum studies students love to see and love to see the collections in them and the like. And also the Earl Harrison House. So that there was a pretty significant set of buildings that I got to know as a Baylor professor, as a board member for Historic Waco Foundation, and even more recently as a member of the City of Waco's Historic Landmark Preservation Commission. So there are all sorts of ways in which this interest in historic homes ties in with things. But in addition to driving around and identifying, then comes the tough part of figuring out when was it built? Mm-hmm. Who lived in it? And I was really curious about the stories behind who the builder was, who the designer was, and who the owners were, because that tells us something about Waco Waco history as well. So that meant many hours in the Texas collection, looking at old city directories, looking at the census records for Waco from 1860 up until 1940. And there are even something called Sanborn Fire Insurance maps, which mapped first to the central section downtown, but expanding to most of the city by 1926, which gave a footprint of each building, the material that it was made of, was it brick, stone, iron, wood, how many stories it had, the roofing material, all to test the flammability of it, because they're trying to figure out how dangerous, how likely it would be to burn down, so you could figure out the insurance rates. So out of all of those sources, I was able to come up with a pretty rich story of it's not just this house has Doric columns as opposed to the Ionic columns of the house next door, which can be interesting or can be made interesting. But how did a family get the wherewithal to buy a lot in Castle Heights and to build a nice two-story mansion? Sometimes there are families that you can track over generations and starting out living in an old Greek Revival house, but then building nicer mansions on Austin Avenue and finally moving into to Castle Heights. So that those sort of stories, it kind of gives agency to the people who are involved in this, that these houses are the decisions that people made, the options that were available for them at the time, the materials that were available. So it makes it something less than a static building, but actually seeing how these houses related to Waco history at the time.
This is Baylor Connections. We are visiting with Dr. Kenneth Haferty, Department Chair and Professor in Baylor's Department of Museum Studies and author of the recently released book, Historic Homes of Waco, Texas, which we are discussing, and themes that you found while researching. Were there any themes or threads that were most intriguing to you, most interesting?
Well, one of the things that has never really been written about in any sort of systematic manner is the non-mansions. I was wanting to make sure that this was a book that was not simply Mansions of Waco, Texas, although that probably would have been a bestseller as well. But I wanted it to be a book that reflected as much as possible the entirety of Waco's population at the time. So it includes many lovely and impressive houses on Austin Avenue and in the suburbs, but it also includes many one-story houses. I refer to them as cottages in the book. A lot of times these were like the owners of mom and pop grocery stores or an artisan glassmaker who there was a company founded by Richard Stransky called Waco Art Glass. Sounds like something that would be happening today, an artisan opening a shop and creating glassworks. Well, that was happening in the 1920s. And in fact, a lot of those houses on Austin Avenue have glass that was made by this craftsman, Richard Stransky, who lived in a nice little cottage. So you can see where he was living, but also the sort of things that he produced in these houses, but also studied the shotgun houses, the few that are remaining here in Waco. And that was quite interesting. And managed to find a number of houses that were built for African Americans in Waco, and those houses tend to be woefully underrepresented in surveys of American cities. So to be able to do that was really great. It was kind of hard because so many houses had been torn down. But it turned out that probably the best cluster of African American houses was around the former Paul Quinn College. The Rappaport Academy campus now. So I was able to find teachers' houses, a carpenter's house, the house of a couple who sent all of their daughters to Paul Quinn, and they all became school teachers. So there are all these wonderful stories about Waco and folks of all sorts of immigrant groups. So it makes for a much more interesting story than they crawled or clawed their way to the top and built this lovely house. And there's certainly that. But there are lots of other people's houses whose dreams were not quite so ambitious.
Mm-hmm. Visiting with Dr. Kenneth Hayfortiep. He is the director and department chair and professor of Baylor's Department of Museum Studies and author of the book Historic Homes of Waco, Texas. Shifting gears a little bit, at the top of the program, we talked about your areas of study, and you've long studied and advanced the discipline of the study of material culture. What exactly does that phrase mean? And I know to some extent we've been discussing that over the first moments of this program.
Yes, speaking in English and we didn't know it, and speaking about material culture and we didn't know it. Material culture is a term that has been used in a number of disciplines in anthropology and archaeology for the built remains and the way that human beings have modified the landscape through buildings, through the way that they farm, through gardens or cemeteries that they create. Anything that involves human agency that changes the natural world can be looked at as material culture. In the way that I tend to use material culture is informed by the fact that I'm a professor of museum studies at Baylor University, in the types of material culture that our students are going to be asked to interpret tend to include things like historic houses, which become historic house museums, or historic villages, your Colonial Williamsburg or your Dallas Heritage Village or what have you, and the things that are inside those houses. And so those are the sort of things that I focus on very closely in a lot of my classes. So there's that sort of interplay of the particular type of material culture. There are other aspects of material culture that could be done as well. You know, material culture can study industrial sites, you know, factories and the like. And there are just many different ways of dealing with using material culture as a method. I'm hoping one of these days to do a book about the pioneer generation of gravestone makers, which will be called Pioneer Marble Men of Texas. And that's something that's really been understudied as well. So material culture can involve a wide variety of artifacts.
Visiting with Dr. Kenneth Hayfortiep here on Baylor Connections. And Dr. Hayfortiep, I've seen some of your columns in the Waco Tribune Herald and elsewhere. And yeah, you've encouraged people who own historic or older homes to be circumspect when considering renovations and changes. So if someone has a historic home or home that reflects a period, what are some ways you recommend that they can update and modernize while still preserving what it is that makes that home unique?
Well, one key principle that we historic preservationists tend to emphasize is reversibility, if at all possible. For example, if you have a house with a brick facade and it's never been painted, the color and texture of that brick are part of the historic character of the house. It may be that there's a compelling reason for painting that, but once you paint a brick house, you cannot go back again. You can choose the next color to paint over when you tire of the first color that you've painted, but there's no way of taking it back to its original appearance. The same thing is true when you deal with changes to the floor plan in a house. It becomes very difficult to go back. Now, if you have a wooden house or a house that's already painted, you know, you can just go ahead and keep on painting. That's A-OK, because you're not doing anything. There's no net loss to that because it's been painted from the beginning in the case of just about every house with wooden siding. It's another thing that's important is thinking in terms of original things like windows and roof materials that are original features of the house, and to change those are a really drastic alteration. Some houses had slate roofs or tile roofs, and unfortunately, with our modern standardized building culture, we have very few craftsmen in Texas who can do repairs on old windows. And it's the argument is, oh, it's just cheaper to get new windows. But if you have windows with six panes on top and six bottom, and you replace them with one big pane over one big pane, it looks very different. And you've lost something of the historic character of those windows. It's kind of a related thing to that. We're having a lot of discussion in Waco these days about our landfill and what to do with the landfill. And a reason for holding on to those original materials is that guess where that old roof is going? To the landfill. And not only that, but the new roof that's going on is going to be a 20 or 30 year roof. So within the next 100 years, you're basically going to have several roofs from that particular house going into the landfill. A roof like a slate roof was originally a 100 year old roof. And if you take care of it every year or so, you know, replace the couple of tiles that of slate that fall off, it's still a 100 year roof. But nowadays in our throwaway culture, we install 20 to 30 year roofs and think we're doing a good thing, so that we can be much more intentional in terms of conserving original fabrics that will also create less problems for us in terms of the landfill at the end of the day.
Do you find people are more open and receptive to that intentionality? What do you find in terms of people wanting to preserve that?
It's a mix. And, you know, part of it is that you know, a lot of times the people who are evaluating the integrity of materials in a house or parts of a house are also the people who are hoping to sell a new product to replace that. So that can kind of skew the discussion if the person who has an economic motive to replace a part of the house is also the person who's giving you advice. So from my point of view, I think that it's important to get an objective outside assessment as to whether or not that's needed or not. Because a lot of times the original parts have much more character to them than any replacement is going to have. And really to repair is really turns out to be, you know, just as cheap in the long run as installing a feature that's probably going to give out in a matter of decades.
Dr. Haferty, we are rapidly, unfortunately, approaching running out of time here on the program, but I want to remind people again, your book, Historic Homes of Waco, Texas, is out and available. I'm assuming they can find that in a number of different outlets, ranging from online to in the community.
Yes, they can, including the Baylor Bookstore here on campus. Awesome. And the Mayborn Museum shop has it on sale as well.
That's great. So a number of places
yes.
to find that.
Dr.
Kenneth Haferty, thanks so much for joining us. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Dr. Kenneth Haferty, Department Chair and Professor in Baylor's Department of Museum Studies, our guest today on Baylor Connections. I'm Derek Smith. A reminder, you can hear this and other programs online, baylor.edu/connections. Thanks for joining us here on Baylor Connections.